It's music from Bob Bennett. He calls it a song about baseball, and so it was. 12 and a half minutes after the hour. It's a Tuesday morning. It sounds awfully strange, but I'm about to introduce Dr. Don on a Tuesday. He's been with us on Monday mornings forever. This is the first Tuesday. Don, I'm a little, well, I don't want to say I'm surprised you remembered, but I'm delighted you remembered.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Of course I remember it. I'm just glad we didn't have it on Monday.
Well, yeah.
I wouldn't have been too coherent on Monday morning.
Yeah, I'm glad we all. Well, one of the reasons we changed again from the prison.
So.
Yeah, what's the name of that ministry again?
It's called Malachi Dads.
Malachi Dads. And so he goes to the Slammer on Sunday nights and works in this ministry. And it's how far from where you live?
It's about an hour and a half.
Healthy drive, yeah.
Yeah, so we leave about 4 o'clock, get there 5:30 or so, start the program around 6. That goes to about 8:30, and then we head back home. So I don't get home.
See, we were starting to notice that Don was a little groggy Monday mornings, and so we said, are you okay? And then he explained to us that he has a pretty demanding Sunday evening. So we said, well, we can move this thing to Tuesday, you know. And he said, so we'll do that now. So this is now the regular day. Dr. Don Clark, a biochemist and member of the board at Creation Moments. And we talk with Don about things scientific, creation and evolution and science and faith and those issues. And we've got a hot one today, don't we, Don? This is this has to do with paleontologist Neil Shubin. And wouldn't you know it, Don just dropped off here. Let's see if we can. Oh, we think we just lost everything here. Well, this is not a good sign. Let me see if we can get him back here. See, this is what Skype does to us sometimes. You hear those funny noises. It's Skype going in and out, and I think we're going to get them both back. Dr. Don now whirling down out of the cloud. There he is.
I'm here.
Yeah, we lost both.
Now, this never happens on Mondays.
No. Oh, yeah, wow, maybe it's Tuesday, obviously.
I don't know why. Can't explain why that happened. Just the vagaries of the digital world, I guess, here. But I was explaining that this is an article. It was found it over at Newsweek. Dr. Don found it for us. It has to do with paleontologist Neil Shubin and his discovery of what he ages as a 375-million-year-old fossil of a fish that appeared to have both neck and hands, it says. And how do you pronounce the name of that fossil, Don?
That's a good question. It is
Tiktaalik. Tiktaalik.
Tiktaalik.
Okay. And I'm looking at pictures of it, and I don't know how we can conclude all this. For one thing, I'm not sure. 375 million years is an age and a half ago, isn't it? I've never heard of this age, the Devonian period. Explain that to us.
Well, I mean. Again, you know, the reason why this fish was aged at that age is because the layers of the sediment that it was in the Antarctic. So,
But then, how do they age
Ellesmere
the layers of
Island in 2004? Actually, he found this fish in 2004 in sediment layers in Ellesmere Island. In the Arctic Canada. Okay. But he only found the front half, so he found the head and he found the front part of the body, but he didn't find the rear part. Mm-hmm. And so at that time he got all excited about it because it was different than several of the other fish that have previously been found, but it is in a group of fish called lobe-finned fish.
Lobe, L-O-B-E, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting discovery because the front fins had a structure like a hand, for example, and the connecting bones. And instead of the front fins connecting directly to the skull, there was an intermediate bone that was between the skull and the connecting point of the arms, if you will, or the fins. Mm-hmm. The front fins, as opposed to the the back fin.
So something between the head and the shoulders then, sort of, you could think.
Right. Yeah. So he said, well, okay, that's the start of a neck. Mm-hmm. And so we got a start of a neck. We've got these bone structures that look like they could be, you know, could obviously evolve into hands. And so therefore, this is a great discovery. And we, you know, we go on from there. Now, it just so happened in 2010, he goes back to the same general area and finds the another sample of the same fish, and he finds the rear end as well, and most of the fish. And why is the rear end important? Because fish normally have big front fins and smaller rear fins. Mm-hmm. But therefore the pelvic girdle where the fins, you know, actually attach is a normal fish is relatively small. He got all excited about this one because the pelvic girdle or the pelvic bone, if you will, was larger. And so the conclusion that they made from that was, oh, well, this fish is ready to come out of the water and ready to start walking. So we firmly believe, or they believed that this is a definitely a transitional fish from going from a fish to a reptile or something, you know, a four-legged tetrapod.
Well, on the Wikipedia page, it says the Tiktaalik is understood as representative of the evolutionary transition from fish to amphibians. And there, of course, again, is that word evolutionary. It's like it's the basic assumption. I'm searching for evidence of that, and I don't see it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the interesting thing, it's still a fish. Mm-hmm. It is not, and a relative of this particular fish, for example, let me see if I can pull that up really quickly, is also a lobed fish, and it's called Colacanthus.
Yes, I've heard of that. Yeah, I've heard of that. Prehistoric fish, yeah.
Yeah, prehistoric fish.
So that's also a lobed fish, and that was thought to go extinct in, you know, in 80 million years ago. Mm-hmm. But one was actually trapped in a trawler net off the coast of India and in 1938. And since that time, many more of these samples of fish have been trapped, and the fish is found in caves and in overhangs, if you will, on reefs.
And I've heard it pronounced coelacanth also, by
coelacanth.
Coelacanth is the preferred pronunciation. Yeah.
Okay.
Like I said, it's also a lobed fish, but it's got the pectoral fins are small, and the front fins are large like normal fish. So mm-hmm. it kind of got booted out of the transition from fish to amphibians. And also when it was found alive, that kind of ruled it out as well, because it came along and
folks was not a fossil.
The species still
it was
survived,
no longer a fossil, although there were fossils of the fish exactly mm-hmm. like the fish found. So it turned into a living fossil as opposed to a fossil that we don't have any we haven't discovered any representatives mm-hmm. alive today. Mm-hmm. The one of the major differences between fish and, let's say, a reptile, for example, or even other bony vertebrates, is how their bones are formed. In a reptile or in humans, for example, the fetal form, it's actually more of a cartilage type bone structure that then, so it's pretty soft and pliable, but then calcifies and turns into bone as the fetus ages, and finally, of course, when it's born, it's now fully boned.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case with fish, and it's not the case with tickleick as well, or the other fish we just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got a problem from that point of view about about this fish. Well, how do you change the mechanism for bone formation? And that's never addressed, by these folks. They just look at the morphology or the structure and say, oh, okay, because this looks like hands and looks like, feet, and we got a larger pelvis now with the tickleick, it's obvious that it, evolved into. Well,
that's a long leap. I mean,
it's a very large leap.
Yeah. I question the basic logic here, because if you assume evolution and then you find something that looks similar to something else, the first, now I'm simplifying this just for the sake of discussion, but you jump right in and you say, well, one came from the other.
Well, exactly.
Yeah,
and of course, evolution is a bottom-up type of approach to what you see, and creation is a top-down. And so evolutionists will use similar structures and similar DNA and homologous DNA between different animals, for example, and point to that as saying, you see, this animal obviously evolved from this animal because the DNA is similar.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about the monkey and the human comparison a while back, almost a year ago, I guess. If you're looking from a bottom up, you're saying, well, okay, you have to have similar DNA between the two. But when you talk from the top down, it's, if you've got a designer who's designing everything, why wouldn't there be similar structures? I mean, the structure works, and this is the way, that the design went. And so why wouldn't you find that in a lot of different creatures? Why wouldn't you find similar proteins in all of life?
That seems to me like a much more reasonable assumption. If you see similarities, you would think common design. That there's a reason for that being that structure. Let's say five fingers of the hand, we see similar structures in some birds and their wings and fossils and so forth. You would think, well, that's a good way to design it, rather than one developed from the other. And it seems to me that if evolution holds true, we should have fewer species in our history than we do now. And that, I don't think the scientific record holds to that. We had actually more species of plants and animals if you go way back.
Well, we did, and I'd like to consider it instead of species, because species can have several species from the same kind,
okay,
of animal. But if you go back to the genus kind, being more related to a family.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a simple example of a kind. If you take the dog kind, well, you got all the different types of dogs that we've got, from the small Chihuahua up to the Great Dane, and everything in between. And those are of the same kind. But you also have the coyote and the wolf. Those are also of the dog kind. So. Obviously, you can have thousands and thousands of species, but yet only have one kind. Now, clearly, several kinds have died out or have gone extinct. The flood is obviously one reason, although all of the land animals were carried in the ark, as well as the birds. And so we can't blame necessarily the flood on the loss of kinds. But then we had this event after the flood called the Ice Age, where in North America, for example, 90% of the animals were lost. 90% of the kinds of animals were lost in North America due to the Ice Age, and 70% in Europe, and that type of thing. So a large loss of species during that period.
We're
losing, we're not gaining new fish, or we're not gaining new species or new, we can gain a new species just because of the variation within
local
a kind,
variations,
but we're not gaining new kinds.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And the problem with evolution, the biggest problem with evolution is it still does not describe how you can gain information. How do you get new structures? How do you get new information into going from one kind, even if you choose the kind, for example, or the fish going to an amphibian? How do you get new information? And of course, the typical answer, the wave of the hand type of answer is, well, mutations, and you just wait a long time. But that's not what we find. I mean, that's not what we, well, we certainly can't observe that, because there's never enough time for these things to change. And the fossil record itself shows that, there was a burst of life. And, these folks date the layers in the rocks or in the sediment, and it is actually sediment. It's not sediment. It actually was mud laid down at the time of the flood. These mud layers are very distinct. And if they were laid down over millions of years, as the evolutionists would suppose, then the layers wouldn't be well-defined. These layers are so much well-defined, for example, that the layers that you see in the Grand Canyon cover most of the United States. How do you explain that? The layers are so well-defined in some cases that the difference between one layer to the next is a very sharp edge. Clearly indicating a catastrophe happened to lay those down. And the layers being laid down by water action and by high-speed water. One of the famous layers in the Grand Canyon, for example, is what's called the Red Wall Limestone. And it's thought that that was laid down as a slurry of basically dead crustaceans and dead sea animals. They certainly died when they got buried, but they probably were alive at the time. And so it was a slurry, but that slurry, to lay that down like it did, had to be moving at least 11 miles per hour. So it was going fairly fast across.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the United States. That limestone deposit is found over in England, for example. So how do you get that that same deposit being stretching across continents? Of course, you can explain that by continent drifts, plate tectonics. But some major event had to happen before the plates actually broke up. And, of course, the the global flood is a beautiful model for explaining how that could possibly happen.
Well, you're positing this as not so much an act of faith, but as logic. I mean, this is logical. This is a rational conclusion based upon direct observation.
Well, it is, and your starting point is a historical record.
Mm-hmm.
that we have in the Bible. Of course, if you don't believe the Bible, if you don't believe even the first verse in the Bible, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, then and you throw that out as evidence, then, and you know, if you have to stay in your own little black box and try to come up with some type of rationale, what you're left with is, look, I can see these animals around me. I can see these fossils around me. There had to be some natural cause for all of this variation. And so I'm going to just call it evolution, and one species evolved into the next. But, you know, no evidence for that. Mm-hmm. No direct evidence for that. Even no evidence in the laboratory where you can do experiments and try to cause mutations. For example, they've caused hundreds and thousands of mutations in the fruit fly. And every mutation in the fruit fly either killed the fly or maimed it in some way, but did not improve it. Mm-hmm. It didn't change into a bird, or it didn't change into another insect even. It was still a fruit fly, but it might have had, you know, a defective eye or defective wings, mm-hmm. or a defective wing on one side. But none of the mutations, and the experiment went on for months, and fruit flies multiply quite rapidly, as you know. And so you could get hundreds of thousands of mutations and hundreds of thousands of generations through this experiment, and nothing positive came out of it.
Nothing supportive of evolution.
No, I mean, it didn't improve the animal. It didn't improve the insect.
No super fruit fly.
And wow. The fruit fly, you know, it didn't change into a fly that could metabolize, could go after something else besides mm-hmm. fruit. But it was only detrimental to the fly, or at mm-hmm. best it was neutral. It didn't harm it so much that the fly could survive and multiply. So this is what you see over and over again. Folks, even this fellow Neil Schubert, for example. Shubin, mm-hmm. In his book, he wrote a book, and it's Your Inner Fish, A Journey into the 3.5 billion year History of the Human Body. Mm-hmm. and it's a storybook, basically, of how we evolved from the primordial soup again, mm-hmm. Of course, using Tikalik as an example of how fish crawled out and got to be amphibians, and then from there into other types of animals, and then finally we get to man. Mm-hmm. And using fossil examples and DNA analysis, all to explain this story. And like I said, the story is based on the assumption that we must stay in this black box and we can't go outside the box, even though we have a historical record of how we were created from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. But we can't use that as evidence for the stuff that we see around us.
Now, there's another aspect, and that's the aging here. 375 million years old. You say they would have dated the fossil by the layer that it was found, layer of sediment or mud in which it was found. How did they date the layer? I mean, somewhere along the line, somebody took a wild guess, is all I... I mean, radio... We've talked about aging techniques in the past. What technique would go back that far and account for that many years?
Well, there is a aging, a dating technique that dates the layers based on the pollen that is found in the layers. So, different layers may have different types of pollen, and so therefore, we can date the layer based on the type of pollen. Mm-hmm. At some point in time, you're going to either have to do radioisotope dating of the layer, or something, you know, to substantiate even the pollen. I mean, you know, where did the pollen come from? Well, it came from plants that grew at that particular time in history. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, from creation, we know that all the plants were formed at the same time. You know, day three of creation, the plants were formed. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't long periods of time between different types of plants. And we know at the time of the flood that, you know, all of these plants were available. And again, probably because of particle size, they are separating into these different layers of mud because the water is flowing at different speeds with the different sized particles in them, creating these different layers.
And of course, that can be demonstrated experimentally. I mean, how different size particles sink to the bottom and layer themselves at certain speeds. Now, we were recently talking about a find. I'm thinking it was in Colorado, maybe in another mountain range, where there was actually wood encased in rock that had been aged by science to be very old, and yet there was wood that was alive at the time these rocks were formed because the wood was encased. Do you remember that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that was, actually encased, I think, in kind of like a volcanic tube, mm-hmm. Volcanic rock had, the lava flow apparently was pretty fast in the piece of woods. And these are found, I wouldn't say that they're common, but you do find these, from time to time. In multiple layers. Mm-hmm. That was the other interesting thing is that the wood was still preserved. Now it was charred on the outside, but mm-hmm. inside the wood was still preserved. But they're found through multiple layers of rock, mm-hmm. which obviously was at that point was layers of mud.
And the point would be that the wood was dated younger than the surrounding rock.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how did that happen? Okay. Mm-hmm. So you got a piece of wood sticking through multiple layers at different ages, according to the evolution time frame. But yet it goes through multiple layers, and the wood is much, much younger than any of the layers that it's found in.
But you see, that doesn't support evolution, so we throw it out. And we don't talk about it.
Well, it's an anomaly. Obviously, the wood had to be put there. After the layers were formed. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's not very satisfying because there's no disruption of the layers, near the sample that was found. Mm-hmm. But what does support the obvious evidence that you're finding is, you know, a global flood or a major catastrophe, certainly in that local area, causing this the layering in the first place, and it's easy to see how a piece of wood encased in volcanic rock could get wedged in between multiple layers of mud because mm-hmm. it was all laid down at the same time.
Well, it's an interesting conversation, and we talk about this time and again. In fact, if you come to Broken Road Radio and go up to the podcast tab, you'll find 2 years' worth of our conversations, podcasts with Dr. Don, and we address many of these same topics over and over and over, and it never ceases to fascinate me how evolutionists can cling to that whole notion and how evidence to the contrary tends to get buried, not published, disregarded, ignored, or considered an anomaly. The Fish Within Us is the article we're discussing. It's on Newsweek, and we'll link to that with today's podcast. You'll have a link to that article. You can also look up the name of that fossil, Tiktaalik. It's Tiktaalik. Wikipedia has a page on it. But read it with both eyes open, and I think you'll see some holes in this.
Maybe third eye open.
Yeah, maybe so. Dr.
Don? I just read a small discussion with them. And, you know, one of the things that I've noticed that I found curious, Don, was that, and I did a Google search of Tiktaalik rosea. And, you know, most of the articles are by creationists or from a creationist point of view. I'm disturbed that there are not other scientists out there trying to look and examine this piece of information and to try to either replicate it or agree with it or disagree with it. And there doesn't seem to be much. It's almost
the fellow who found it, he's Neil Shubin. Yeah. He published several papers, and he's kind of like a fossil hunter, and he published several papers on this, which were, in reputable journals. And of course, he probably, and I didn't read the papers, but he probably has an evolutionary slant, and therefore, can get some notoriety because of it. But if you publish the same information, the same data, which is I found this fish that looks interesting, and here's its features, and it points to creation, just like everything else that we find, in the fossil record, that wouldn't be published. But indeed, it's the same story, but from a different, perspective. I mean, from a different worldview, if you will.
Yeah.
Well, there's an interesting statement in this article from the paleontologist Shubin, and he says, as a species, we are actually kind of jury-rigged. Now, to me, one of the basic premises of evolution is that the subsequent generations of creatures get better and more adapted to their environment, that somehow we get more and more streamlined and more perfect from very elementary and rudimentary beginnings. But he says here that the extraordinary disconnect between our past and our human present means that our bodies fall apart in certain predictable ways. He says he refers to our clunky evolution as human beings as if it was a devolution.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, we're the problem, of course, there's sin in the world, and our perfect bodies, we know from Genesis that we were made perfect, that everything that God had created after the, by the end of the sixth day, where he created male and female in his own image, everything was very good, or everything was perfect. Hmm. And then, of course, we've discussed this many times, that over time, things, because of sin, mutations came into the system, which then causes different types of diseases. And he would point to, one of the examples he would point to is sickle cell anemia as being a good thing, because, look, the folks in Africa survived malaria because they had sickle cell anemia. Well, guess what? Sickle cell anemia can kill you.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's rather deadly.
It can be deadly if it's not treated fast. When your blood cells go sickle, or when they go from a circular disc to a long needle, that's a problem. We've got the evolutionists point to that as a benefit, as opposed to a detriment to the individual.
Well, and, David, so I can hear it come. It happens almost every week. Go ahead, Dr. Don. Go ahead. Tout your theory of devolution. Mm-hmm. I'm waiting for the book to come out.
Yeah,
now.
It's very interesting, because I keep going back to Genesis, because that is the foundation of our historical background, our historical knowledge, for example. But even in Genesis, when Genesis gives quite specific dates of people's ages, not only before the flood, but post-flood. And the post-flood ages follow very nicely, and maybe we've talked about this before, mm-hmm. follow very nicely a mutation rate for humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so you go from, for example, before the flood, 900 plus years, very rapidly down to 120 years, which then degrades down to 80 or 70, or 70 to 80. After that.
And of course, in Genesis, God decrees that he'll limit man's lifespan to 120 years. And then when you consider the number of human beings that were available to repopulate the earth after the flood, you see the lifespan decreasing, which and we've covered this just a few weeks ago. It's in one of the podcasts here from, I think, probably July, about how it fits the pattern of decreasing lifespans of resulting from inbreeding, which we can do experimentally with various kinds of animals. The lifespans become shortened when the breeding stock is limited, and there were 8 people on the ark that survived the flood. And there's an interesting way to trace lifespans down to 120 years. They simply degrade to about 120 years and level off. There's a plateau there. And so said God in the book of Genesis.
So, yeah, Genesis chapter 6, verse 3. right before the flood. Well, actually 120 years before the flood. Yep. Anyway, yeah, I mean, so... Like I said, this historical document that we have, we shouldn't ignore it. It is certainly part of our history. We don't ignore other historical documents, but we want to ignore the best historical document that we have.
Well, see, it nudges us off the throne is what that does. We can take exception to that.
Yeah. That's what it all boils down to, obviously.
Dr. Don Clark, biochemist, and again, member of the Board of Creation Moments, and I would recommend a visit to their website. It's creationmoments.com. You can link to them from us at Broken Road Radio there over on the right-hand side of our homepage. There's a convenient link, but you'll find all kinds of information there, resource material for your own studies or maybe your small group discussions. Your church might be interested in some of those things for their library. Lots of good reasons to visit Creation Moments, and it's creationmoments.com is the website. And Don, as always, thank you so much. It's good to have you around, even if it is Tuesday.
Well, it's good to be here, and I'm glad I'm very much awake this morning.
And we'll look forward to next Tuesday as well. So, Don, have a good week, and thanks so much. Appreciate it.
All right, you too.
Bye-bye.